From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how pets and other animals are helping to solve crimes. No, they're not becoming detectives. They're being used as witnesses, sort of. The fur, saliva, or feces from an animal at the scene of the crime is often found on the suspect, which is where the DNA testing comes in. We'll talk with Beth Wickham of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis, which conducts forensic animal DNA testing. Also, the science, history, ethics, and politics of stem cell research. We talk with biomedical ethicist Christopher Thomas Scott, author of the new book, Stem Cell Now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How's this for an interesting job? Helping to solve crimes using cutting-edge science and animals. That's kind of the job description of my guest, Beth Wickdom. She analyzes animal DNA in cases where an animal has been the victim, the perpetrator, or a witness. Okay, the animal can't exactly take the witness stand, but you can prove that a suspect's clothes had traces of the fur, saliva, or urine of an animal that was at the scene of the crime. Beth Wickdom is the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. It's one of the largest animal DNA typing laboratories in the world. I asked Wickdom for a favorite crime story her lab helped solve. There's been so many, she found it hard to choose.
I think my favorite one, though, was a triple homicide case. And mostly it was my favorite because we didn't expect to get DNA results. In this instance, the person who was accused of shooting the three people claimed he had never gotten out of the vehicle. And they found a shoe impression in a pile of dog feces. So police submitted a piece of feces about the size of a pencil eraser that they had gotten from a shoe, and we were able to match that to the feces at the crime scene and place him at the crime.
Well, that's great. So he was convicted because of the DNA of the feces?
Well, that was a part of the evidence. In most of the cases, there's quite a bit of other evidence. You have witness statements, ballistics, and, you know, tire tread, the usual forensic evidence, and our DNA evidence plays a part of the total picture, just like as human DNA evidence would.
The use of human DNA in crime solving is pretty new. How did the use of animal DNA in crime solving get started?
Well, they went pretty much hand in hand. Along the same time that DNA tests were being developed in humans, our laboratory was also developing DNA tests in animals for use in verifying bloodlines in animals. We do a lot of horses, cattle, dogs, cats, llamas.
This is for breeders, deer, to make sure that the breed is...
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
We have contracts actually with different breed registries to do DNA profiling. So we had the marker panels in place. It's just the ability to take those panels and apply them in a forensic setting. We had a fair amount of experience with postmortem samples where breeders had neglected to DNA profile their animal before it died. And so in order to register the offspring, we had to get a DNA profile from the dead animal. So they were sending in all kinds of body parts. And we got pretty good at getting DNA out of very marginal samples.
Is it helpful when you want to get DNA, say, at a crime scene, is it helpful that animals tend to shed and lick and pee a lot?
It can be. Just like with humans, the best DNA from a hair sample is going to be if it has a root. But because animals do groom themselves, particularly dogs and cats, sometimes we will get DNA off hairs that you would not be able to get DNA from in a human situation. And we get DNA from a variety of other samples as well that they don't see so much in human work.
So what is the best material for animal DNA testing? Well, if you had your choice of what specimen to use, what would it be?
Probably a hair with a big fat root. That would provide so much DNA, but those aren't the type of samples we usually get.
What do you usually get?
Again, there's such a variety. With human criminal work, a lot of times it's shed dog or cat hair because it transfers so easily from the victim to the suspect on their clothing, in their car, so on. If you know, have a pet, you know how easily it transfers. And also that's the most marginal type of evidence too, like I said, because it doesn't always have roots. But sometimes you get lucky and you get a result. Oftentimes too, we will get tissue. We're working on one case right now where there's actual animal parts. It's an animal abuse case. So unless it's been left out in the sun for a very long time in warm temperatures, it would be very good. There'd be lots of DNA there, no problem at all in getting a profile.
Do you often get calls from the police?
More and more we're getting calls from the police. Word is getting out that we're here and that we're doing this kind of work. A lot of times people didn't know that the lab was here, but they contact their veterinarians, their local universities, and we're getting more and more referrals from people like that.
Tell us about a case that you were called in on by a police unit.
Well, actually, this was one of our earliest cases. This was a sexual assault on a woman who was working in her yard, and a man pulled in a pickup truck and was asking for directions. And while he was talking to her, her dog urinated on his truck tire, and he dragged her into the truck, tried to sexually assault her, but she fought him off and called the police. And she was able to describe the truck to the police, but when they had him in a lineup, she couldn't pick him out. So the police came to us at that time and asked about doing DNA testing on the urine on the truck tire. So they swabbed it and sent it in, and we were able to match the DNA from the truck tire to the victim's dog, and again, placing him at the crime scene.
Truck tires are so filthy that I would have thought that the DNA evidence from the urine would have been corrupted in some way.
No, because the primers that we use are species specific. And so as long as the truck hasn't been sitting out in the rain or in the sun for very long, the samples were taken within a day or two of the assault, it would be fine. Mm-hmm. DNA is a very stable molecule.
Can you give us a sense of how long it takes to do a DNA profile and what that process is like?
Well, the process is going to vary according to the quality and quantity of the DNA. If you're dealing with shed hairs, it can be a lot longer than if you're dealing with a pulled hair with a root. We've had cattle cases come in one day and go out the next. But typically, we say to allow 4 to 8 weeks for testing. And if you're testing a case, for example, a dog attack case where there's large amounts of clothing that has blood, it has hair, it has saliva, it's even taken up to 3 months for testing in cases like that.
And why does it take so long?
Because there's so much evidence, and you're dealing with marginal evidence. We had one case, dog attack case, that was actually ended up being a homicide because they took the woman off life support. And in that instance, we tested her jacket because there was a lot of blood on it, and we could not get dog DNA. So we actually ended up reading in the newspaper the story of her assault, and they were told that she was attacked on the right leg. So then we had to go back, and we targeted the right leg and got a DNA profile. And in that case, the hospital had put the clothing in a plastic bag and left it at room temperature for a month before we got it. So it was just covered in mold. And so it was not an optimal evidence to work with.
Yeah, it also sounds really unpleasant.
There is that aspect, especially when we were doing post-mortem with the horses people would dig up. We would try to get them just to send in a tooth or two, but a lot of times they want to send a whole head or a whole leg, and we only need a little bit.
When you say send, exactly how do they send a specimen like a horse head?
FedEx.
Really?
Just wrap it up real well so it doesn't leak.
Wow. Do the FedEx people know that?
I don't think so.
Okay. And what's a good civil case that you worked on?
Well, we get a lot of civil cases that are just lost or missing animals. People want to know if a certain dog killed their cat. We get a lot of those. Actually, the most interesting ones are usually the ones where they end up being a surprise. Like, for example, there was one woman whose cat was killed, and she had seen the neighbor's dog in her yard several times, and they suspected it was the dog, so we tested it with our typical dog primers and didn't get results. We thought, what are we doing wrong? So we ended up backtracking and just doing a generic species identification test, and we came up with bobcat, which completely surprised everybody.
Did anybody know there were bobcats in the vicinity?
She didn't. But their property backed up onto a wildlife preserve.
Wow. So an innocent dog's life was spared.
In that case, yes. Yes, our own little innocence project.
My guest is Beth Wickdom. She's the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Beth Wickdom. She's the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. We're talking about her forensic work using animal DNA to help solve crimes. What's the bread and butter in your lab for animal DNA testing?
Well, the laboratory itself, like I said, does parentage testing. We are kind of a subunit of that laboratory that does the forensics. Bread and butter, probably the biggest component up until recently was cattle rustling. We've done quite a few cases from almost every state in the West, but again, we're sort of a victim of our own success because now when the brand inspectors tell the suspects they're going to get DNA testing, they usually end up working out a plea deal, so we never see the samples anymore.
So for cattle rustling, how would that work? What would your role be?
Well, cattle rustling has been on the rise since we banned Canadian beef, and the prices for U.S. beef have gone up. And typically the cattle that are rustled are calves that are unbranded. They may be out in the field standing next to a fence, and so they're very portable. Somebody could just take them up and throw them in the trunk of their car, and they sell for $400 or $500 a piece. So in those sort of instances, when they get calves that where the brands have been altered or they're unbranded and they don't have the correct documentation, they'll get suspicious. They'll call the brand inspector, and they will check with ranchers that have lost calves who will supply DNA from the cows, and then we'll get DNA from the calves and do a parentage analysis to see if they are indeed the offspring of those cows, and we can then return them to the ranch from which they were stolen.
In the forensic work that your lab does, was there ever any resistance? Were courts ever reluctant to accept animal DNA as evidence?
In my experience, they've been very generous in allowing animal DNA evidence in. I think we've benefited from the human DNA challenges that were experienced in the last decade. And so now human DNA is pretty well accepted, and we're using the same types of equipment, the same protocols to do animal DNA testing. So for the most part, it's very well accepted. I only know of one case where it was thrown out, and that we're not the laboratory that did the work in that case.
Have you ever gotten a call from Scotland Yard?
Yes, we have. Back in the year 2000 was the first time they contacted us. In that instance, a bouncer at a club had been stabbed in the heart, and there was a trail of blood leading away from the crime scene. But when they tested it, it wasn't human. So that's when they called us up and asked if we would do the testing. And at first we said no, but eventually they talked us into it. So they flew over for a week. Actually, in this instance, the person who originally contacted us got bumped by his supervisor, who decided to bring the samples to California for a week. And we did the testing, and we were able to match the blood on the sidewalk to the suspect's dog, who apparently, during the altercation, had gotten his ear nicked with the knife that was used on the bartender.
That's really interesting. You say at first your lab said no to this request from Scotland Yard. Why?
Well, at that point, we were just starting to dabble in the forensic field. It was becoming apparent that there was a need there, and we were getting started, but we weren't really set up as a forensic laboratory. And to deal with somebody like Scotland Yard is pretty intimidating. And so, but there wasn't really anybody at that time that could do the work, so they talked us into doing it.
So how did this case from Scotland Yard change the lab?
Well, it really validated to us that there was a need for what we were doing and that it was important work. And to work with somebody like Scotland Yard was great. I mean, there were wonderful people and very professional, and even though they were, like I said, intimidating.
You've been called in on a lot of animal abuse cases. What are the typical cases like?
There really is no typical case. We've done everything from testing sticks or weapons up into testing pieces of tissue. For example, one of our earliest animal abuse cases was what we call the puppy chopper, where a man was observed putting unwanted puppies into a chipper shredder. And the mother ran off with one of the puppies, and we were able to take tissue from the chipper shredder and match it to the mother to show that it was an offspring of hers. And in that case, the man got a couple years in jail. But the good thing is, in that case, the good part of it was that the mother and her puppy became poster dogs for animal abuse. And they were adopted by the veterinarian that was working on that case.
What a horrible story.
Yeah, sorry. A lot of the animal abuse cases are. We have another animal abuse case that was really interesting because in that instance, there was a case of serial abuse where they started out shooting hamsters, putting them in a pillowcase, having a fight with them. Then they escalated up to shooting a bull with some razor arrows. They killed a goat with a machete, and then they attacked some llamas with a meat cleaver. And then finally they attacked a llama and killed it with broken off golf clubs. And in that instance, we showed that the suspect had llama blood on his shirt, and they went to jail. But I'm particularly proud of that case because you could see the escalation, and an FBI profiler said this was the kind of person that would go on to eventually become a serial killer and attack humans, which indeed, when he was in prison, he talked about going on and killing orangutans and apes at Butchart Gardens.
Wow. This isn't the kind of work that really increases your faith in human beings, is it?
Not really. You see a lot of dog attacks, which can be vicious, especially on young children, but the dogs are acting instinctively. When you see what people do to animals that is just pure evil, it's horrendous.
Is there a particularly bizarre story you were called in on?
Well, we've had some bizarre requests. One that leaps to mind is some hair testing. We were asked to verify that the hair came from a Bigfoot. I told them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I told them that we could only tell them if it didn't come from a Bigfoot since we didn't have a positive Bigfoot sample to compare it to.
Well, that's a real flaw in your lab, isn't it? That you haven't gotten one yet.
Well, we're working on our Bigfoot database.
Do you have a file of unidentified DNA? Like DNA that doesn't fit into any species that you know of?
And, I'm afraid
maybe
not.
Maybe it is a Bigfoot. No?
No, no. There is a genetic repository called GenBank where DNA sequences are uploaded. So that's the first place you go to compare DNA sequences. And if it doesn't match anything in there, then it probably doesn't exist.
What got you into this work in the first place, and what did you expect you would be doing with the knowledge that you had?
Well, I never thought I'd end up here. I was a zoology major, and I went to work at the laboratory doing blood typing. And then as we started the DNA testing, I became very involved with that and developed a lot of the tests that we're using now. And when the forensics unit was started, I was asked to head that up. And so I had to learn forensics as I went. And so it's been interesting. It's been a real education. And like I said, we're always learning something new.
Do you have pets?
Yes, I do.
And what do you have?
I have a dog, and he's actually our positive control for the laboratory.
What does that mean?
Well, every time you run a sample, you have to run positive controls, which is a known, and negative controls to make sure that there isn't contamination. So he is our known sample that we run with every dog case.
I bet he'd be very proud if he knew that. So what did you get, good dog hairs with a root on them?
Actually, we do the same thing they do in the human world, which is we use what's called a buccal or a buccal swab, and it's just a swab on the end of a stick that you run in the suspect's mouth and collect epithelial cells from the inside of the mouth. Because DNA is DNA. And some people don't realize the DNA from your hair is going to be the same in your mouth, from your muscle.
So just curious, like with your dog, when you did the DNA testing, did you learn anything about your dog's breeding or heritage that was interesting to you that you didn't know before?
Well, I learned he's not wolf.
Did you think he was?
There was some question. I think he's part husky, and so he has that wolf look, and we didn't know where he came from. So we were able to eliminate the wolf and just show that he was dog. That's what every laboratory would like to do, is to develop a test that shows breed. And right now, there isn't any reliable test, because most dog breeds have evolved just within the last few hundred years, so they're not that genetically different. Between a Chihuahua and a Doberman, there's not that much difference.
is there any reason why all of us who have pets should go out and get DNA specimens, or is that a kind of pointless exercise unless there's a good reason for it?
It doesn't take any effort to collect a DNA sample, and I always recommend people do it. You can just pull some hairs that have good roots. If it's an animal like a dog that typically sheds a lot, you can just get a cotton-tipped applicator, run it around their mouth about 10 times, and collect cells. Just let it air dry, put it in a paper envelope, don't put it in a baggie, and stick it in a drawer, and it'll be good for years and years and years. So if there's ever a question about your animal being stolen, you can always pull out a sample and have a known sample to compare it to.
Well, I never would have thought of doing that. Putting a swab in an envelope and keeping it there for years just in case. That's really interesting. Do you think more and more people are doing that now?
I hope so. It'd make our job a lot easier.
Would it?
Oh, absolutely. Instead of trying to get little pieces of hair or feces from the home, we could actually just test the swab and have a good DNA profile the first go round.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us about your work. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Beth Wickdom is the acting director of the Veterinary Genetics Laboratory at the University of California, Davis. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Send Me, a debut work of fiction that explores family, love, loss, and forgiveness by Patrick Ryan. From Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start March 6th at capella.edu. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audio books, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the hype, the science, the ethics, and politics of stem cell research. We talk with Christopher Thomas Scott, Executive Director of the Program on Stem Cells and Society at Stanford University's Center for Biomedical Ethics. He's written a new book called Stem Cell Now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Philosophers, theologians, medical ethicists, and politicians are wrestling with the questions surrounding embryonic stem cell research. The new book, Stem Cell Now, addresses many of these questions and explains the science of stem cell research and what the research may be able to achieve. My guest is the author, Christopher Thomas Scott. He's the director of the Program on Stem Cells and Society at Stanford University's Center for Biomedical Ethics. Here's how the National Institutes of Health describes human embryonic stem cells. Quote, stem cells are cells that have the remarkable potential to develop into many different cell types in the body. Serving as a sort of repair system for the body, they can theoretically divide without limit to replenish other cells for as long as the person or animal is still alive. When a stem cell divides, each daughter cell has the potential to either remain a stem cell or become another type of cell with a more specialized function. such as a muscle cell, a red blood cell, or a brain cell, unquote. But as Scott explains, not all stem cells are embryonic.
Stem cells come in two varieties, two basic varieties. One is the embryonic stem cell, the most powerful stem cells. Those come from early human embryos. The second variety are called adult stem cells. Those actually appear during fetal development. So adult isn't quite the right term for them, but they persist throughout adulthood, and that's why they're called adult stem cells. Adult stem cells are not as powerful as embryonic stem cells, and the two are very closely related because they have similar behaviors.
And what are the similarities and differences?
The similarities between embryonic and adult stem cells is that they both make more of themselves. It's a behavior called self-renewal. So adult stem cells make more stem cells, and so do embryonic stem cells. So they're, in essence, immortal. The differences between adult and embryonic stem cells is that embryonic stem cells can make any of the 200 cells in the body. It's a process called differentiation. And adult stem cells, because they're developmentally older, are more restricted in what they can become. So a stem cell in the blood, for example, can make any of the 9 different kinds of blood cells, including red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets.
Now, you've said in your book that the reality of stem cell biology is overshadowed by the hype. What do you mean?
Well, embryonic stem cell biology and regular adult stem cell biology are two parts of a very important discipline in sciences. And I believe that embryonic stem cell research is just one part of a larger picture. And because embryos, human embryos, are used for embryonic stem cell research, that particular fact has been part of a very vigorous and acrimonious at times debate about whether we should be using early forms of life for scientific research. And that part of the debate, often the shouting that goes on in that debate, often eclipses some of the other very important results that are coming from the adult stem cell field. And it's important to note that embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells are close relations. They're part of a large family of cells that exist. And without understanding embryonic stem cells, a lot of the important information about adult stem cells is lost. In fact, Liz Blackburn, who works at the University of California, San Francisco, she was also on the President's Commission for Bioethics, said that one can't find answers to questions about apples by doing research on oranges, but you can learn about fruit in general, but the nuances of disease are very, very specific. And that's a very telling statement, because if embryonic stem cell research is prohibited, as it is effectively in the United States, the adult stem cell knowledge that we can gain from understanding the family in general is also slowed.
Well, that's a kind of catch-22, because the president, for instance, would like scientists to pursue adult stem cell research and just do very, very limited embryonic stem cell research.
Right, it is a catch-22, and it's a little bit like learning something about your significant other, I suppose, by finally meeting the in-laws. If you see that the father is drinking milk right out of the carton from the refrigerator, it makes a lot of sense that you would see it actually in your mate, too. So learning about adult stem cell research, those insights, many of them will come from the embryonic stem cell field.
What's the difference between the potential of the two or how they behave? I mean, if adult stem cells were easy to work with, then it would be no problem to abandon embryonic stem cell research and just focus on adult stem cells.
Adult stem cells have a few finicky behaviors that makes them very difficult to work with. One is that they are rare, so it's hard to find them in the body. The second thing is, once you've found them, they are devilishly hard to cultivate in the laboratory. And the the promise behind embryonic stem cell research is that embryonic stem cells make adult stem cells. So they're the early ancestors of adult stem cells. So knowing how to actually create adult stem cells from embryonic stem cells can kind of solve the problem of lack of numbers.
What are your hopes for what scientists will eventually be able to do therapeutically with stem cell research?
Well, the good news is that adult stem cells are already used in therapies. Cord blood is another area of interest for clinicians. Cord blood taken from the umbilical cord of babies are very powerful. They are used to cure some cancers in children, especially cancers of the blood and some genetic diseases. So there's a lot of very promising research in the cord blood area too. And then there are a bunch of clinical trials going on right now using stem cells that are found in the joints of our knees, there are also blood stem cells being injected into the heart. Those trials are rather controversial at the moment and just beginning.
What are some of the diseases that you think are most likely to be treatable at some point in the not-too-distant future with stem cells?
Well, I think the far future, whether we actually use embryonic stem cells to create organs, is many, many, many decades out. The near future will be inroads into therapies for, I would say, diabetes is a very fertile area of research. There are trials now starting for spinal cord injuries using derivatives of embryonic stem cells. Certainly, some of the most interesting work will actually be using embryonic stem cells and stem cells as tools to discover drugs or to understand how disease progresses. The nice thing about using human stem cells in the laboratory is that they can mimic a disease, a much easier way of studying a disease than studying it in patients who suffer from it.
My guest is Christopher Thomas Scott. His new book is called Stem Cell Now. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Scott. He's the author of the new book, Stem Cell Now, and he's the executive director of the Stem Cell and Society Program at the Biomedical Ethics Program at Stanford University. The president has restricted federal funding for stem cell research. Only certain lines of stem cells are allowed to be funded. And before we go any further into that, would you just give us the basic refresher course in what that means?
An embryonic stem cell line is a immortal line of cells that is grown in the laboratory. Those cells come from the 4 to 6 day old human embryo. So that's what an embryonic stem cell line is. Before President Bush issued his proclamation in August 2001 saying that the government would restrict research on embryonic stem cell lines, there existed, by some accounts, about 70 lines worldwide that had already been created in embryonic stem cell laboratories. Since that time, those 70 lines have dwindled to about 10 to 20. The 10 to 20 lines that are now on the registry that are usable are good for research purposes, but none of those lines are usable for therapies. So since 2001, researchers in the United States cannot use government funds to work on embryonic stem cell lines, create new ones. Now, private money can be used to work on lines, new lines that are created in the United States, and government money can be used on these 10 to 20 lines that that are usable on the registry.
Why is federal funding so important? I mean, it's not like stem cell research is illegal. It's just that you can't use federal funding for most of it. So what's the importance of the federal funding?
Well, federal funding is the thing that drives most biomedical research in the United States. The NIH, for example, the biggest funding agency, pumps in about $27 billion every year into biomedical research. So it is a big source of money that propels the basic science of the United States. And without that resource, the research quite simply goes more slowly. And there have been some that say, well, you know, this money can come from other sources, foundations, private individuals. Well, I don't know many organizations or individuals that have pocketbooks like $27 billion. So the result really is that much embryonic stem cell research, the new results are coming from other countries such as Singapore, England, Australia, Israel, where embryonic stem cell research is permitted.
What impact is that having on science in the United States?
Well, there are a couple of things that come to mind. One is that the United States is accustomed simply to being in the lead on this area, in this area, and the fact that we now lag by some measures is disconcerting to the biomedical community, to patients who are looking for cures, and to generally the kind of the stem cell biologists who work on this. The second thing, the more troublesome thing, I think, is that it has created an environment in the United States where young scientists may be choosing other careers. Now, I don't have any hard evidence for this. This is anecdotal, what I can determine from talking to people in laboratories nationwide. And that's that when the young investigators choose a career, they choose a career based on how well that career might be funded from all sources, including the government. And if they look at their possibilities for becoming professors, assistant professors, associate professors, and full professors over their career, and see that the government hasn't been excited about funding the research that interests them, they'll pick another career. And what happens with that is that once those young scientists pick different careers, you create a knowledge gap inside the American academic system. And with that knowledge gap, you lose a bunch of things. You lose the ability to train new students. You lose the ability to bring therapies to patients quickly. You lose an institutional or maybe a scientific memory about this very important area of science. And that knowledge then goes to other countries.
There's a few states that are trying to make themselves centers of embryonic stem cell research. By doing what?
Well, in California, they passed a Proposition 71, which was a bond measure to fund stem cell research of all types, not just embryonic stem cell research, for the next 10 years. It's a $3 billion initiative that still has yet to take effect. Other states are jumping on that bandwagon, passing measures to fund research through state funding mechanisms. And then there are other places where money can come from. The large philanthropic organizations such as the Howard Hughes Medical Foundation, the Stowers Institute, and others have stepped up and funded stem cell research in the tens and twenties of millions of dollars level.
How effective do you think they'll be in compensating for the money that isn't coming from the federal government?
Well, I don't think it's going to be very effective. It certainly is a start, and tens of millions of dollars here and there is better than nothing, for sure. But until we get a national policy that puts us right at the front of what we should be doing in biomedical research, I'm afraid that America will be looking to other shores for the new discoveries and perhaps the new therapies. I think that would be a terrible thing to actually have American patients that are suffering from disease have to travel overseas to get their therapies because we couldn't do it here first.
You study the social and ethical implications of stem cell research. So how do you go about trying to think through the issue of the ethics of embryonic stem cell research? Where do you begin?
Well, I begin with the embryo. That is the subject of all of the debate about whether we should be using embryos to derive embryonic stem cell lines or leaving those embryos alone. Those are the two questions. And when I think about use of the embryo as a very early form of human life, it helps me to reason through what that early form of human life is about from both a biological perspective and also from a moral perspective, how I feel about it, what my values are about that embryo. And this is a personal choice and a personal decision of mine, that I believe that an embryo at the 4 to 6 day stage is not a human being. It's not capable of suffering, either experiencing joy or pain. It is something that we should hold in high regard, and in that respect shouldn't be used in a capricious manner. On the other hand, I'm very sure of what I see when I see someone suffering from diabetes or someone who is paralyzed because of an injury, automobile injury. And I know for certain when I see patients in the hospital near where I work that those folks are indeed people and they indeed are suffering and that their families suffer, and that as someone, as part of a biomedical community, a community of scientists who are studying these amazing cells, that it is a duty, really, an obligation of mine and other people who work in the field agree with me on this, to try to use these cells to help that suffering and help those people who are injured. So it really comes down to the definition for individuals that are looking at this in terms of how they feel about the embryo as a form of human life. I feel the embryo ought to be used for biomedical research. There are others, many on the religious right, who feel that the embryo is sacrosanct and should be just left alone.
President Bush appointed a commission on bioethics, and the commission has advised him on stem cell research, but that commission has proved to be pretty controversial. For what reasons?
Well, the commission issued a series of reports that basically underscored the party line, the Bush administration party line, and the controversy really surrounds how the members of the commission were appointed. Now, presidents can appoint executive commissions like this in any way they choose, but in this particular case, the commission was seen to be very much on the neoconservative right. Those members were known by their own publications and writing to be in opposition to working with embryos, in vitro fertilization, anti-abortion, were among the stated positions that they had. And so as a result, it was no surprise to see that the commission's findings were very much in line with their earlier thinking. Now, commissions in the past, presidential commissions on ethics in the past, in my view, have been more balanced, and as a result, the policy that has come out of those commissions is more balanced. One example of that is the towering Belmont report, which is a legal document that tells us how we should treat patients in biomedical research. So I think history will look back on this presidential commission and perhaps judge it against some of the others in terms of how effective it was and how pluralistic it was in terms of setting this very important policy for America.
My guest is Christopher Scott. He's the author of the new book, Stem Cell Now, and he directs the program on stem cells and society at Stanford University. It's part of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Scott. He's the author of the new book, Stem Cell Now, and he's the executive director of the Program on Stem Cells and Society at Stanford University. It's part of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford. You know, we're talking about embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells. So obviously, adults have stem cells. Do we know we have them? I mean, what could I possibly identify a stem cell in my body, and what function are they serving in my body now?
Well, no, you couldn't identify a stem cell in your body because they're extremely hard to find. They're very, very low numbers. But if you can isolate enough of them, you can kind of figure out what they do by their properties. They have very unusual behavior. I like to think of it in terms of how we regenerate ourselves. So, for example, we're basically falling apart and being rebuilt every second. Human body is. We lose about 1 billion cells of every type every hour, and 1 million skin cells drop off every day. And the red blood cells are the most ephemeral variety. We lose billions of them every day. And without a way to replace them, we'd simply fall apart. For example, our intestines, that's an area of a very high cell turnover, so there's a lot of stem cell activity there. Our intestines would disappear in 2 days. Well, mine would probably disappear in 1 day because I like spicy food. Our skin would fall off in 3 weeks, and we'd run out of red blood cells in 4 months. So without stem cells, we'd be nothing but a skeleton and maybe a few organs limping along, a kind of interesting way of looking at the regenerative potential of adult stem cells. And it's because of this regenerative potential that scientists get very excited about how they could be used to regenerate organs or tissues that have problems of because of disease, or even more wonderfully, organs that die as we get older. So stem cell therapies and regenerative medicine really looks at a lot of different things. One of them is the fact that as we get older, we lose that regenerative capacity. Our stem cells get older too. If there were a way to keep them in a culture, in an incubator somewhere, then imagine as you get older putting those stem cells back into the body and living a longer life. Now, living a longer life isn't always a good thing, and there are a lot of ethicists that I work with who think that 150-year lifespans are probably not a good idea, and I can understand that. I mean, I just turned 50 and I'm sick of myself already. I don't see how I'd like to live maybe another 100 years, but it's definitely something to think about. That's how stem cells could perhaps extend our lives.
Does the fact that we lose so many cells every minute and that they're replaced by adult stem cells, does that have an impact on how you see embryonic stem cells and the ethics that you apply to the embryonic stem cells?
Yes, it does. If the adult stem cells, which are the older, developmentally more mature type of stem cells, if they have the potential that rivals the embryonic stem cells, then you have a much different case for use of stem cells for therapies. So adult stem cells are more restricted in what they can become. an adult stem cell in the blood, for example, can make only blood. It can't make, for example, a heart muscle, although there are some that would disagree with that. The skin stem cells, for example, make only skin. The stem cells that are present deep inside the crypts, these little places, involutions in our intestine, make only new intestinal cells. But embryonic stem cells, on the other hand, have this powerful ability to make any one of over 200 cells and tissue types in our body. So if science can figure out a way to manipulate embryonic stem cells down these pathways for intestines, for brains, for heart tissue, for new pancreases or new skin, then you have a single source that could be used over and over again to generate tissues that are failing or that are injured in a body. That's the promise of embryonic stem cell research.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Christopher Thomas Scott is the author of the new book Stem Cell Now. He directs the program on stem cells and society at Stanford University's Center for Biomedical Ethics. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at BN. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times, about the Hamas victory in the Palestinian elections and how it's affecting the Middle East. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.